Thanks for joining this episode of Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. I'm real excited about the interview you're about to hear. It's with Don Winslow, and we're going to be talking about his latest novel, City on Fire. It is an epic Irish-Italian crime novel set in the 1980s and 1990s. This first book of a planned trilogy is set in Rhode Island. Don Winslow has written over 20 books. I've read 6 or 7 of them. 2 of the books have been made into movies, Savages and The Death and Life of Bobby Zeeb. And he is one of my favorite authors to read in the crime fiction genre. City on Fire was originally scheduled to be published in 2021, but Don Winslow wanted to be able to do an author tour in person, so the book was published this year on April 26, 2022. Next up, my interview with Don Winslow. Don Winslow, author of City on Fire, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Don, early part of the book, at the very beginning of the book, you talk about your inspiration in part being the stories of Homer and the stories of Virgil. So I looked it up. You know, I had read excerpts from Homer in the past, and this particular character, is it Aeneas or Aeneas?
I always pronounce it Aeneas, but, you know, neither you or I were around when it was written, so I don't think anybody, you know, knows what the correct pronunciation is. So I say Aeneas, but
Aeneas. Know. So yeah. Aeneas is sort of the inspiration for Danny Ryan, your protagonist. And one of the things I found as I did some research on the stories about Aeneas in the Iliad is that he was aggrieved with Priam because in spite of his brave deeds, he was not given his due share of honor. And so that's one of the characteristics of Danny Ryan, whose father previously ran the Irish gang that ultimately is at war with their former partners, the Italian mob. And he's sort of a sergeant slash lieutenant. And he's an interesting character because he's not really sure he wants to even be there. And at the same time, he feels like he's not necessarily, as you get, you know, further into the book, that he's getting the due he thinks he deserves.
Yeah, you're dead on, you know. He's the son-in-law, you know. He marries into this. He marries the youngest daughter of the Priam character, Big John Murphy. And yeah, I don't think Danny does get the credit, you know. At the same time, I think it might be on even page 2 of the book. He's already talking about going, you know, leaving, going to California before any of the trouble even starts. I chose him precisely because he's a bit of an outsider. Do you know what I mean? He's got 1 foot in and 1 foot out. That allows him to be in on the action, but it also allows him to comment on it as a bit of an outsider.
And I like the arc of the character in the book, but of course, I believe this is going to be a trilogy.
Yeah.
So this is, I would say, the first arc of the character.
Yeah.
One sort of the first arc, because it's tragic in many ways. Mm-hmm. And I said, but this is just the first book.
Yeah. You know, if you follow the life cycle of Aeneas, you know, he has to leave. He has to leave his home and he flees with his son and his dad, his elderly son and his elderly dad and his infant son, and wanders for a long time trying to find a place to put his feet. And I loved that arc. Then he has to go and build an empire. And I loved that arc too.
Oh, I know what now. I know the arc of the books.
Generally, you do.
Generally speaking,
the thing that so hoped, and you know.
Well, so. Let me tell you what really got me excited.
All right.
A little, because I have a degree in accounting, so when I understand literature a little bit, I get really excited. So, what really got me excited is the parallels between Aphrodite and Madeline.
Yeah. Thank you. That was a challenge, but it was a fun challenge. What do you do? Who is a Greek goddess in 1987 in Providence, Rhode Island? How do you
She is a goddess of sorts.
He is a goddess, and but how do you make that live and breathe in a modern book? And for me, that took backstory. Aphrodite in the Iliad just literally drops in, decades after having abandoned Aeneas when he was a little boy. So Madeline, left, dropped Danny off with his old man when he was just a baby and disappeared. Now she's back and she has to rescue him. So that was kind of a tough get, and I had to go back into mythology to look up Aphrodite's background. What happened to the young Aphrodite that made her who she is? And I discovered this marriage and these affairs and all kinds of things. And to try to make her a modern, powerful woman, I started her off as sort of a courtesan who developed her own stock portfolio, became a very canny investor, became very wealthy, and therefore has the power and influence to try to help Danny out.
Well, you write characters like Madeline. I know that you're thinking, what can I do to still make the audience, still make the readers empathize with her and like her despite her flaws? Talk about that process of creating that type of character.
When I'm inside typing a character, writing a character, I can't be objective. That's not my job. My job is to not make moral judgments. My job is to bring the reader into a certain world. And the way I choose to do that is to see that through the eyes of the characters. And so I think that any time that you can make the reader relate to a character in any way, that starts causing empathy. And empathy is what I want. Now, the reader might look at it objectively and say, boy, that's a bad person, or boy, she does terrible things, or he does bad things. And that's fine. That's the reader's take on it. I can't have that take when I'm writing.
Leah Murphy is the brother of Danny's wife Terry, and of course Danny's best friend is Pat, who's also the brother of his wife. And Leah Murphy struck me as a character where some characters learn from the experience of going through this war and the death and the tragedy that comes with it. And some characters hold on even harder to their characteristics that have caused some of the pain and tragedy.
Well, I'm following the character of Paris in the Iliad, who starts it all with Helen of Troy. Liam has such an ego. Do you know what I mean? Liam has too much of an ego to learn. He thinks too much of himself to ever gain a lesson from any of his life experiences. And that's kind of his tragedy. And unfortunately, his tragedy becomes a tragedy for a lot of people.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up because when I think of Pamela, who is the ingenue of a sort that sort of causes this war because of the choices that the Morelli brothers make and Liam makes, she is Helen of Troy. And I sort of got to that toward the end because I started off chasing, thinking about Homer and Aeneas, and then I started thinking about Aphrodite. Then I thought about she's Helen of Troy.
It's funny. She enters the book in the first sentence. Danny's laying on the beach and he watches this woman come out of the ocean. He says it like his dreams of the sea, and he knows right away that everything's going to change. Again, it was a matter of finding her backstory. Who was Helen of Troy before she was Helen of Troy? And she was this messed up, rebellious kind of teenager, in the Greek days. And so again, I had to find what's the modern equivalent of that. So I made her this very, very waspy Connecticut rich kid who's doing everything she possibly can to piss her parents off, particularly by dating men that she knows that they won't approve of, that they would absolutely despise. We'll follow her, by the way, through the next three books.
Interesting.
Helena Troy doesn't end at the end of Troy. You know, most of the people who survived had lives afterwards that you can follow mostly through Greek tragic dramatic plays. And so we'll be with Pam for quite a while for the next two books.
So did Helena Troy's mother at some point become jealous of Helen, as
Yeah.
happens to Pamela?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, this was the fun of it. I found in reading these classics, and I came to them, you know, later in life, I think in my late 30s, early 40s, that all the themes and all the stories that we find in my beloved crime genre were already there by the time the Greeks and the Romans finished up. And so when I hit this story about Helena Troy's mother being jealous of her, I thought, God, that's rich. You know, that is really rich to mine for this character because it explains so much of who she becomes and why she does what she does.
When I read a lot of your novels, I'm really starting to think of you as the master of epic storytelling. So, talk a little bit about, in your mind, what's the difference between writing a novel and writing an epic novel?
This is a gross sort of analogy. It's the difference between a 10K and a marathon, you know. Not by the way that I'm a runner. I've always liked long books and big books as a reader, you know. Right now I have with me George Eliot's Middlemarch, you know, on the road with me. It's 800-page book. I like that scope. I like having the ability to deal with a lot of characters over the course of time. With this trilogy, you know, my first trilogy, I did this big trilogy about drugs. It wasn't planned as a trilogy. I quit, in fact, after each book. With this one, I always knew it was going to be a trilogy because I knew there were three distinct phases of Danny's life that fit very nicely into three books. The difference is, this sounds trite, it's simply one of time. You set out to write a big epic and a big trilogy. You know you're going to be with these characters and with these stories for years of your own life. And so it requires a certain kind of patience, I think, and a certain kind of long view to know that, you know, every morning around 5:30, you're going to get up for years. And be with Danny Ryan, be with Pam, be with Madeline McKay. And you get to know them over the course of time in ways that maybe you don't know characters in shorter novels.
But the thing that's interesting to me is with some of the novels I read, when often when I think of them as epic, it's a multi-generational, covering 50 years, covering 100 years. This is basically the first book, which in my mind is epic,
Thank
is
you.
1 year,
One
roughly.
year. One year. Yeah,
1 year.
it's 1 year and a couple of months if I do the math. Yeah, but it's still epic because
Yes.
so much happens, so much changes. And again, we're dealing with epic themes, you know, honor, dishonor, pride, the consequences of pride, revenge versus forgiveness and compassion. And so those are ancient themes. And I think that would give any book, regardless of the time frame it covers, sort of that epic feel.
You forgot lust. There's a heck of a lot of lust.
You're right. I did forget lust. It's definitely in there. Well, look, I mean, lust is the
It's a
driving
trigger.
force. It's the trigger. Thank you. You did better than I did of this action. You know, Liam is in lust with Pam, and she returns it, and that wounds a character's pride, a guy named Pauly Moretti, and off we go.
Also, there's this intergenerational transformation and the decline of the city. So I'm seeing these two things happen. One, Pasco Ferris Ferry is the Italian head of the mob. John Murphy is the Irish head of the mob. They have a certain honor, a certain code. And
Yeah.
then especially on Pasco's side, the Morelli brothers are ready to push Pasco out of the way and
Yeah.
take over. And they think Pasco's a little too soft on the Irish, that they want to be much more aggressive, much more assertive.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the Irish and Italians start as allies, which is historical. And Pasco's about ready to retire, and the Moretti brothers keep thinking, "Okay, dude, retire. You know, you keep talking about going to Florida. Go get on the plane and don't come back." And again, you know, any mob war, really, there can be all kinds of pretexts. In this case, it's jealousy over a woman, but it's always a pretext. The real reason is always about money, power, turf. And really, if you look at those three things, you're talking about just money. The Moretti's want what the Irish have in terms of their rackets. They want to move in on it. They want that cash flow, and that's the real reason for the war.
I want to talk a little bit about Danny's father because he in himself from the very beginning, tragic figure, heartbroken, destroyed by Madeline, Danny's mother, and really never recovers from that.
You know, you'll see a lot more of this backstory, but Madeline and Marty, Danny's dad, meet in Las Vegas. You know, well, 20 something years prior, just before Danny is born, they have a crazy lustful affair. She's not interested in staying with him, but she gets pregnant with Danny. And then she drops Danny off in his lap because an infant doesn't suit her plans for her life at that point. Marty's well on his way to becoming an alcoholic. He drinks his way out of the top chair of the Irish mob, goes into this decline that Danny has to live with. So Danny comes from a mother who abandoned him and a father who neglected him. And so it's little wonder he feels such intense loyalty to this sort of faux family, the Murphys, you know, who kind of pick him up even as a kid.
And he's very honorable. I mean, he's faithful to his wife. He follows orders. But I am curious about his best friend Pat. Your decision to make Pat the head of the mob, the Irish mob, even though the father's the head, is really Pat that's sort of running the Murphy family. Talk about that decision to have Pat running the Murphy family.
Yeah, that came straight out of the Iliad. You know, if you look at the Trojans, the king is Priam, you know, John Murphy, but the guy who's really running the battle, running the war, is Hector, his heroic son. And so Pat is just direct descendant of Hector, you know. And you mentioned earlier the generational aspect of the book. You know, it's very much in play. The older guys, they don't want this war. They do not want this war. They want to live out their lives in peace and enjoy their children and their grandchildren. The younger generation are pushing it and pushing it and pushing it. And that's the case here. You know, the Moretti brothers beat Liam to a pulp because he accosted Pam. And it's Pat who wants revenge for that. You know, while the older guys are saying, "Hold on, wait a second, you know, let's just work this out."
Liam's a blowhard. Yeah, he talks a big game, but doesn't always follow through, though. You gotta read the book to figure these things out. Were there any other inspirations for Liam, that character?
You know, I thought a little bit about some of the Kennedys at times, although I was a great admirer of the Kennedys, but I talk about Liam having that sort of Kennedy kind of sexual charm, you know,
Yes.
that's become kind of famous. But that's about it. I don't ascribe, you know, any of the more negative aspects of his character that way. But really, I was following the character and the personality of Paris in the Iliad, you know, selfish, cowardly. You know, you alluded to it. I mean, he's always writing checks with his mouth that he can't back up with his fists. And when there's a possibility of peace, you know, they have a peace treaty all worked out. This book could have been 30 pages long, right?
Right.
He sabotages that peace by arranging a cowardly attack that keeps the war going, you know.
I thought it was interesting that there's one line the Irish aren't supposed to cross, the selling of drugs. Is that something that's based on fact? Is that really how the Irish mob generally acted, or is that something you sort of conceived for the book?
No, it's based on fact, but all of those prohibitions against selling drugs eventually were honored more in the breach than in the observance. Do you know what I mean? If you
Right.
really look at the history of any mob ethnically, there was almost always an initial prohibition against selling drugs. The profits to be made, though, were so great that almost everybody broke them. It happened famously with the Gambino family in New York, and that's how John Gotti made his rise. He assassinated Paul Castellano in order to be able to have permission to sell heroin because Castellano had put a ban on it. So yeah, there's historical truth to that, but it's probably more truthful the way it actually plays out in the book with guys, saying, okay, don't tell the bosses, but we're going to sell dope anyway.
So let's talk about the Moretti family. So in my mind, at least, they're sort of the antagonist to the Murphy family, Paulie Morelli, Paul Morelli, Peter Morelli. They don't seem, and I'm going to underline that word, as to have the same type of honor code as the Murphys do.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that that's correct. I think that they are more the bad guys in this thing. If we're going to put those hats on anybody, I think that Peter and Paulie are pretty underhanded, pretty vicious. Part of that is the times. The 1980s were the time when organized crime, and particularly the mafia, went into a steep decline. Because of the RICO acts, because they were selling drugs and guys were getting busted, for potentially 30 to life bits. And so they had more motivation for becoming rats. And so you see OC in a big decline. It's counterintuitive. When there's less to fight over, the fighting can be all the more vicious. And I think the Moretti brothers see, the cheese getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and they're willing to do more and more evil things in order to get a bigger piece of a declining piece of cheese.
One of the most fascinating characters in your book is Sal. Talk about Sal.
Yeah, Sal comes from Achilles. One of the principal characters of the Iliad and one of the tragic characters of the Iliad. Sal is bisexual, if not gay, has a gay lover, which I think if you read between the lines of the Iliad and you know a bit about ancient Greek culture, I think it's very clear that Achilles was having a sexual affair and really loved a character named Patroclus, who's also in this book. And so again, we come to a point where there almost can be peace. And then Pat Murphy makes a horrible mistake and kills Sal's boyfriend. And then Sal comes back into this war just determined to kill everybody. And pretty much does. I had a lot of compassion for Sal, because here's this gay man. In a culture, remember we're talking about 1986, 1987, mafioso Italian culture in Rhode Island that's extremely homophobic,
Right.
and so he's trapped, being this personality that he really isn't, and at the end, it cost him his life.
So let's talk about the novel being set in Providence, Rhode Island, because when I saw that it was set in Providence, Rhode Island, I said, "What? Providence?" I said, "Don must have some personal connection to Rhode Island."
Don does. Don grew up there. I think most people think of me as a California guy because I've lived out there for the past 30 years, and a lot of my books, of course, are set there and in Mexico. In fact, though, I grew up in a little fishing town in Rhode Island, first in the outskirts of Providence, and then a little farther south. Now, when you're talking farther south in Rhode Island, I mean the state's the size of a Walmart parking lot, right? So it's a
It's
little
the smallest state in square miles, first or
Yes.
second, smallest.
Smallest,
Yes.
smallest, smallest. Then Delaware, but So, which is important to the story, because when you're writing mob stories in Rhode Island, everybody knows each other. That was the reality, right? You know, if you're writing a New York mob thing or a Chicago mob thing, yeah, maybe they knew each other, maybe they didn't. In Rhode Island, everybody knew each other, and that's important to the sort of intimate relationships in this book. But yeah, this is the first book I've written in my hometown. My wife and I started going, well, I always visited over the years, you know, but my wife and I really started going back about 8 or 9 years ago to start taking care of my mother, who was in her declining years. And so as necessity dictated, we were there longer and longer, and I started to fall in love with the place again. You know, I'd left when I was 17 because there was really nothing there for me. And then coming back, I kind of rediscovered the beauty of the place and the kind of gritty soulfulness of it, you know.
Well, what was that experience like incorporating Providence into your story and writing the story during the time you began to reacquaint yourself again with Rhode Island?
It was mostly good and sometimes a little melancholy. You know, I think any of us who look back at our youths have good memories and memories that are not so good. And I had to sort of confront both of those things, being on the ground all the time. You know, I've joked that the research for this book was walking out the door. You know, I wrote this book in the same, these books actually, in the same house I grew up in, out on my mom's old front porch and a mile from the beach where all the action begins in this book. We live there now 6 months of the year. I'm on that beach every afternoon, virtually, until sunset. It was interesting because, you know, I've known the Danny Ryans of the world my whole life. I've known the Peter and Polly Moretti's of the world my whole life, but I hadn't been around them for decades, you know? And so going back, it was a matter of sort of reintroducing myself to that culture, to that language. You know, the speech patterns are very, very different, of course, from Southern California. And it took me a couple of years to hear it again so that I could replicate it in the book. So it was an interesting process, yeah.
Do you write longhand, or are you typing on a typewriter, or are you typing on your laptop, or how are you writing?
I'd say about 90% of the time I'm typing on my laptop, but I tend to write very fast. And if I want to slow myself down, then I'll take a yellow, you know, legal manuscript pad and write in longhand and then transcribe it later, obviously.
As someone who's been writing novels a long time, I'm always interested in how you feel the transformation of technology from having to go to these reader's guide to periodicals and pulling up those physical encyclopedias and having to physically go visit all these different right. libraries. Whereas today you don't necessarily have to leave your house.
It's amazing. It's amazing, isn't it? Because I'm that old, you know, I remember card catalogs of libraries and that horrible microfiche. Remember
yes.
Hiding those newspapers around the screen and, you know, they're always kind of fuzzy and, you know, you're taking notes and all of that kind of thing. Obviously it's very different, but, you know, I still like to get out on the ground when I can. Now, look, you can get on an airplane, you can get on a train, you can't get in a time machine, right? You know, so if you're going back in time, you still have to do that research, a lot of which now we can do on the net. But to me, it's still important when I can, and I almost always can, to walk the ground, you know, even if I'm writing scenes that were 30 and 40 years ago, for two reasons. One, it gives me a sense of mood, which I think is important. You know this. I mean, place is also a character in your books.
Right.
Right. Has to be because everyone comes from somewhere. But also just on technical details. I remember I wrote a scene one time where a guy's in a restaurant and he's looking out the window and he sees something on the street. And I went back to that restaurant and sat in that table and realized he couldn't see what I had him seeing from that table out on that street, you know. And so to prevent inaccuracies like that, I still like getting out in the field and walking it and driving it and all that good stuff.
When you're in the middle of writing a novel, especially as you're making the dash to finish the novel, do you sort of restrict other things that you read, or there's no restriction during your off time of what you read?
You know, 90% of my reading is research reading anyway. I kind of only have a chance to read for pleasure on Sundays, and that's all I do on Sundays. I go for a walk with my wife, and then I sit and read things that have nothing to do with my work. No, I'm not particularly restrictive. I think maybe it's just because I'm shallow, or maybe because I can compartmentalize, but I'm really able to set work down and see a movie or read a book or see a TV show or do something else and then come back to it and not be particularly distracted or influenced.
So I interviewed an author recently, Gary Phillips, and I made the mistake of saying, "Hey, Gary, tell me some of the authors you want to give a shout out to right now." He said, "Well, Hope, did I can all, I can't, you're putting me on the spot. I don't know." So I said, "Gary, tell me of some authors you love that aren't with us anymore." So Don, tell me of some authors that you love that you think our audience should be reading that aren't with us anymore.
Say hi to Gary for me. Okay. And well, yeah, I mean, the list is long, but I don't hesitate. I mean, for me, Rain, I don't know if you can hear the baby screaming in the next room. It's not mine. Everybody relax. Someone's having a bad afternoon over there. Raymond Chandler, you know, to me will always be kind of the patron saint of noir. Wrote poetry, made noir into just absolute poetry. The late, great, and irreplaceable Elmore Leonard.
Oh God, he was the master.
Oh my, you know, I still mourn him, you know. Late in his life, I had a chance to be on the phone for an hour with him. He just told me stories. It was one of the best hours of my life. I also had a chance, by the way, to go to Raymond Chandler's house. I was in the room where he wrote The Long Goodbye. The bullet holes where he shot at his wife are still there.
Wow.
George V. Higgins, great New England writer who wrote, I think, the best crime novel of all times, The Friends of Eddie Coyle, which was also a great film with Robert Mitchum. The McDonald's, you know, John and Ross.
Yes.
You know, on opposite coasts, but, you know, kind of similar in some ways. There are so many. Charlie Williford, you know, I could go on and on and on.
Well, Don, you have a great afternoon. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Been great talking with you.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.